Dr. Benner with the Shelburne Knee Center podcast, and we're here tonight with my co-host Scott Bauman for another episode. Last week, we had Dr. Greg Miletus from Kaiser Permanente in California on the show talking about lessons learned from the Kaiser ACL registry. So that was a really interesting discussion just about registries in general and also what they've learned from the Kaiser registry and how they've incorporated that into their practice. So a lot of interesting information. If you haven't already looked at that one, make sure to go check out Dr. Miletus's episode. If you'd like to find us on Facebook or YouTube, we have the Shelburne Knee Center podcast pages on those two avenues. We also have Twitter and Instagram accounts at the SKC Podcast. Or if you'd like to contact us, you can do so via email at the skcpodcast@gmail.com.
And tonight's going to be a great episode as well. We're talking tonight about the treatment of basketball players after ACL reconstructions and also getting into sports residencies and overall working with this patient population. So tonight we have Mike Ainbinder here. He's a physical therapist and a certified strength and conditioning specialist and currently is at the University of Cincinnati working with their men's basketball team as part of their sports PT residency. His undergrad was at IU down in Bloomington in Indiana. Then he went on after that to get a master's degree in sports management from the University of Florida, and then went to physical therapy school at IU Physical Therapy School in Indianapolis. And then what we're really going to try to have him answer some questions about tonight is after physical therapy school, he pursued and got accepted into a sports PT residency, and he is currently at the University of Cincinnati and, again, specifically working with their men's basketball team. And besides that, he's been heavily involved with the American Academy of Sports Physical Therapy through the APTA. So he's a younger physical therapist, just graduating about a year ago in 2023, but I think he has a real bright future in the profession. So before we get started, Mike, thanks for joining us here tonight on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it, fellas.
Now, specifically, what we want to talk about tonight is the treatment of basketball players, specifically as it pertains to ACL reconstructions. But before we get into that conversation, Mike, I want to talk to you a little bit about sports PT residencies and really just PT residencies in general. And you may have the numbers on this. I don't have it in front of me, but it's a pretty small percentage of students that choose to pursue a residency right after graduation or shortly after graduation, I should see. So, and I know you landed at the sports PT residency, but my question for you is really why you made that decision to pursue a residency right out of school.
Yeah. Coming out of PT school. Well, I should backtrack. Going into PT school, I knew I wanted to approach that experience with a wide net. As you both know, the field of physical therapy and the profession of physical therapy, the schooling piece provides you and graduates you as a broad, you know, physical therapist. And so I knew I wanted to go into school thinking of enjoying, you know, the sports aspect, the ortho aspect, the neuro aspect, the pediatrics, the geriatrics, kind of all the different patient populations that we serve as physical therapists. But always, you know, underlying theme was that I wanted to be involved in sports physical therapy coming out of PT school. So after my first year at Indiana University, that love for sports PT and that goal for sports PT really became pretty evident in my mind when I became a member of the American Academy of Sports Physical Therapy. And so within my involvement as a student in the ASPT, I got to meet a lot of other individuals that were leaders in the sports PT field. And one piece of that was residency education. And so I knew going into my second and my third year that residency was a step I wanted to take after PT school. The reason for that was that, one, from a sports specifics perspective, working in a professional sports league, a collegiate sports league, or some type of high level athletics, it's pretty challenging to get a job right out of PT school. Reason being is there's usually further education and knowledge and experience that is needed for these roles that serve those higher level athletes. So I knew the residency step would help me get in, you know, in the light of those positions. And then two, I knew coming out of PT school, that I was graduated a broad physical therapist, and I wanted to narrow my focus to just sports physical therapy and dive deeper into that setting of our profession.
Yeah, I hear similar answers to that, and you know, there's always a big question of, do you choose a residency? Do you go on to the workforce? Do you maybe work for a couple of years and then decide if you want to specialize in something? So was that a popular choice amongst your class? I know I graduated probably 10 years before you did, but there we had a class of 45 students and we had zero. I actually take that back. We had one go on to an orthopedic residency, but is that something that was pretty popular within your class or pretty rare, like in my example?
Yeah, I would say pretty rare. The statistics, I think, increased a little bit. So we had 43 in our class, Scott, and four out of the 43 went on to do a residency, two of those being sports. So myself and a classmate of mine did a sports physical therapy residency, and then two did an orthopedics residency. So really, and that's just, you know, comparing University of Indianapolis to Indiana University, that's two PT programs, but, you know, five individuals over 87 plus, mm-hmm. is not a large percentage. So I don't know if it's changed too much with that, even that gap of graduation years.
Now, how about specifically in terms of the advantages of pursuing a residency shortly after graduation? I know you mentioned some job prospects, especially as it pertains to the professional or high-level collegiate programs, but any other advantages that you either thought about as you were in the application process or here you are getting ready to finish your residency here in the next couple months, anything you can look back on and see that as a pretty large advantage as you begin your career?
Yeah, two things come to mind, two big buckets for that. One, which is a common answer for a lot of individuals that have interest in residency, is the mentorship piece of it. So I always knew coming out of PT school, you're given all these skills, you went through all these practicals, these exams, obviously you passed your licensure exam, hopefully on the first time, and you come through that. And that first job out of school is a great opportunity for one, either you develop some really good clinical skills and clinical decision-making skills in the clinic, or unfortunately, sometimes you can develop some, you know, unhappy or not great skills in the clinic. And I feel like doing a residency provides you that mentorship that helps you lean that first side of developing some really good clinical decision-making skills when you're a new clinician. And then, so that was really important to me from that perspective. And then also surrounding myself with like-minded individuals is another piece for me too. I knew that going into a sports PT residency, I'd be involved and be around people that, one, also enjoy sports, enjoy the aspect of working collaboratively with athletic trainers, team physicians, team surgeons, as well as sports performance coaches, sports nutrition, all the other healthcare professionals that provide care to athletes on a daily basis. So I feel like being in that environment, being in that culture around individuals that are like-minded and want to provide the best care to athletes was a great step after school.
I think you make a great point there. And surrounding yourself around like-minded individuals, I feel like sometimes you can't find that for multiple years, you know, into a career, especially from a PT setting, because there are our PT perspective, because there are so many different types of settings. And maybe you land in a good spot your first job or two, and maybe you don't. And I think a big piece of that is surrounding yourself around like-minded individuals. So I've never did a sports or any, I didn't do any residency, but from people that I've talked to that have, I feel like that's a pretty good and common answer. So for people that are looking into it, that want to either specialize or surround themselves, like you said, around like-minded individuals, I think the residency seems like a pretty good option for these students. Now, switching gears a little bit here, and maybe something you have an answer for and maybe you don't. So we talked about advantages, but now moving to disadvantages, now that, again, you have a year's perspective with a sports residency, is there anything that you feel like is a disadvantage of this and something that you think, well, if I was a student, I wish I would have known this? Not necessarily that you would have not done it, but anything you could really look at as a disadvantage when you're, you know, comparing that to the vast advantages of a residency?
So one, you know, low-hanging fruit answer to that question is usually most residencies come along with some type of salary decrease in comparison to a physical therapist that is practicing in maybe a similar, you know, similar setting to you. That's not new news. Everyone going into a residency is pretty aware of it. There's really two ways that programs do it. You either just have a lower salary, and that lower salary is your salary going forward. Usually the pay cut leads to the didactic education, the mentorship, all the support and great systems that are in place for you to succeed as a resident. Or the other is that you have a full salary, but there's a tuition associated with it, which again pays for those didactic education, mentorship, and all the support that is there. So that's one, you know, knowledge that most people that are going to residency understand that it's going to be a lower paying salary in comparison to maybe a classmate that is in a similar setting to yourself. Mm-hmm. Another disadvantage too, I would say, and we'll dive deeper into my experience with it, you know, University of Cincinnati. Your time is going to, your time outside of the clinic and outside of learning is going to be pretty minimal. I don't know if that's a true disadvantage, but if you come out of school thinking that you're going to have your weekends or have a free time, a good amount of free time outside of your time treating patients in the clinic, that's not going to be the case for residency. I saw that as a, as an advantage, to be honest with you, but that's also the nature of residency, and you're going to be busy. You're going to have longer hours. You're going to work weekends. You're going to have times when you're going to be there first in the morning and last at night. So, I would encourage students or individuals that are earlier in the career or want to take that step to residency to understand the commitment from there. And it could be a disadvantage depending on your personal life or what you, you know, envision coming forward. But it's definitely the truth of how residency is built.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the two very good points. And, you know, I would kind of look at that as an advantage as well. You know, it is a finite amount of time that you're here. It's not that you're, you know, taking a residency for an indefinite amount of time. So knowing it's only a year, personally, I would want every opportunity possible. So I understand it's pretty rigorous and the hours can be long and things like that. But if you're choosing to do this, I feel like you need to, you know, dive head first and really attack it and take advantage of those opportunities. And then the financial piece, like you said, and I think every student understands that when you discuss residencies. But as you had mentioned, if it leads to a dream job or some type of higher level job, you know, it's kind of an investment. You put that into yourself and you bet on yourself and hopefully that pays off in the end. So, but two good points.
It kind of reminds me of orthopedic surgery fellowship. These conversations you're having here sound a lot like the same things that people talk about after you're done with orthopedic surgery residency and whether or not you want to go on to do a fellowship. The financial piece is even more stark contrast if you're talking about an orthopedic surgery fellow salary versus a first year practicing orthopedic surgery. They're not even close to one another. And it is, you know, I kind of think that when it comes to fellowship, and I think as you're talking about residency, I think it's very similar. If you have something that you think is a deficiency in your previous training that you'd like to get more information about, then I think that's one reason to do it. And the other one is just if you find that you want to be an expert in something, you know, we all have the opportunity to try to figure out what kind of practice we want to be in. And, you know, none are more specialized than our office. But you know, the people that are there at our office that are specialized in that way, myself included, are there because we chose it that way. We wanted to be a specialist and an expert in a couple of things rather than having less knowledge on a lot more things. And, you know, we can't know everything about everything. So sooner or later, you got to figure out which of those two you fit into.
I completely agree. Yeah. I would even think going off both of those two, it's from a physical therapy residency perspective, the opportunities after is great. But another, maybe going back to your initial question, Scott, from an advantage, there might be a misconception of, all right, I finished my residency or fellowship in PT. That means I'm going to get this great job that's going to pay me more money. Sometimes it's not, actually not the case. You might get a job that's great and in a setting, but the salary might still be lower, or the training that you get within residency does not guarantee that you're going to get a higher paying salary at a job that someone else might get at a lower paying salary. So those are some things you have to understand going into residency, and then figuring out what's best after you is really important as well.
You may have to grow into a job like that if you want to be a specialist. Correct. Even if you have a specialty fellowship or a specialty residency, you may have to grow into it and doing some more generalist things at the beginning and then finding a way to, you know, get yourself into a more nuanced or niche type position. So all great information. Thanks for all that. But let's move on. It's a good segue into your experience working with the University of Cincinnati men's basketball team, which you just finished up your season doing that. And Scott and I were both curious to hear kind of overall, how was that experience for you?
The experience was great. I appreciate you both asking. So my role with the men's basketball team at University of Cincinnati was the physical therapy resident. So my mentor, Bob Mangine, is a dual credentialed physical therapist and athletic trainer. And so he was the main individual that provided medical care to the men's basketball team on a daily basis. I'm thankful to Bob every single day for the teaching that he's done for me and the growth I've had alongside him. His teaching style was allowing me to learn by doing. So with that being said, I had a lot of involvement in the men's basketball team care, from a event coverage, basketball practice and game coverage. I was at every single practice, every single game. I had to travel with the team, which was great. So that was a really cool experience, especially because it was our first season in the Big 12 for Cincinnati. So being involved in those, you know, true basketball season experience was really, really cool. And then from my clinical side, when a men's basketball athlete was deemed necessary for formal rehab, he became a patient of myself. Bob and I work collaboratively every single day for that individual's care. But Bob instilled the trust in me to be the lead on most of the plan of care, with touching base with him as we move forward, depending on how the patient progressed. So I got to be the head PT in that sense for the men's basketball team as well. So the experience has been second to none, in my opinion.
So you talked a little bit about your roles within the department, which was my next question, but let's talk about just what's a day in the life as a sports PT resident at the University of Cincinnati. What's the schedule like, and how, or is there one? Is it more just you take whatever comes to you on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, it's a great question. Great way to put it. So definitely dependent. I would put it in two main buckets. It's either in season or out of season. So I'll go in season first. So our first 20-hour week, and when I say 20-hour week from the NCAA's perspective, is when we were pretty much full in season, that the coaches can be with their team and their athletes for 20 hours, started the beginning of August. And so from August, let's say first for easy math, until when our last game completed at NIT, we worked every single day, 7 days a week. That's how big time Division I and professional sports goes. We did have 2 days off around Christmas, so I guess we worked those 2 days. We had a break for Christmas time. But during the season, I looked at it more as the day of the week did not matter. It's really three different days. So it's practice day, game day, or off day. And so practice day for me consisted of, since I'm also the Olympic sports physical therapy resident, in the morning I would see athletes from UC that were not men's basketball athletes. So I'd see people, you know, individuals from the women's basketball team, lacrosse team, track and field, volleyball, swim and dive, and soccer, probably the main six or seven other sports I worked with. So from, let's say, 7:30 until around 1 o'clock, I saw athletes from those teams that needed care. And then around 1:15, 1:30, my basketball hat went on. And then from 1:30 till around practice was on the court around 2 o'clock, I was helping with pre-practice treatments, taping, anything to get the guys ready for practice. Then Bob and myself would cover practice from around 2:30 till when practice is over, let's say 4:30 or 5 o'clock. And we would do post-practice treatments, if anything, you know, triage any type of acute injuries, depending on how practice unfolded. And then that'd be done around 6:30 or 7. And then I either would do some notes or documentation for the day, as well as some didactic learning, and then rinse and repeat the next day. Games days were similar in terms of, you know, athlete care in the morning for the other Olympic sports till around, you know, 1:30 or 2 o'clock. We'd have a shoot around at 2:15 till around 3:30. Team meal will be at 3:30, and then it'd be pregame prep until the game tipped off at 7. Hopefully we won the game. Obviously that was not the case for every single game we had this year, unfortunately. But that's the nature of college basketball, especially at this level. So game would be over, triage, just like post-practice, post-game, to make sure everyone's feeling good, and then probably head out of the arena maybe like 10:30 or 11 o'clock. Off days were, for me specifically, was more focused on just athlete treatment care for all the athletes from the other teams at UC, as well as any of the guys from the men's basketball team that needed some more care on an off day. And then we just wouldn't have practice in the afternoon. So my afternoon would be a little bit more open. I would try to have some patients scheduled at that time, or get some other things done that maybe I was a little bit behind on as well too. So that's the in season. The out of season, which we're currently in now, similar in terms of my athlete care. Now it's just working on all the athletes from every team besides football, since I'm the Olympic sports and men's basketball PT resident, and just providing care in the training room at the University of Cincinnati. So 100% of my time is spent in the training room at UC. I don't have any time that is in the clinic of a UC health clinic, and then 30 hours a week of training room coverage. 100% of my time is spent in the training room at UC, which allows me to collaborate a lot with the other healthcare professionals.
I want to back up quickly and have you talk more to the in-season piece of what you were just discussing, specifically with the practice days and the game days. So I guess I have two questions. When you say you were involved with treatments at practice and things of that nature, I think all the therapists listening know what that you know, the treatment table side of things looks like. If somebody has an ankle sprain or tendonitis of the patella tendon, something like that, and you're seeing a patient really on the table and doing some more gym rehab based exercises. So when you said you were involved with practice and things, how involved were you? Is that something where you were on the court with these guys from time to time, working on different drills, more off to the side with some of the guys that are working on rehab? Because I think that's everybody that gets into PT school assumes that's what you're going to do. You know, I'm going to be a sports PT, I'm going to work with athletes. Sometimes you really don't get that on court experience. So from an education standpoint, I can't speak for IU, but I know at UIndy, we weren't really educated on field, on court type rehab. So my first question is, were you involved with those types of things and what did that look like in season?
Yeah, so I was for sure. So the on-court piece, obviously at this level of collegiate, you know, athletics and basketball, we have a well-rounded and strong coaching staff, as well as a group of GAs and then managers. So from like an on-court drill perspective, I was not involved in like being a passer or a rebounder or some type of defensive individual during practice. There'd be some times though, if a guy was rehabbing back from an injury or some back from a condition, that I'd be on the court with them, helping them getting shots up, getting their legs back under them, just getting more comfortable being back on the court. So I did that a good amount of times with our guys, either off the side during practice or at a specific scheduled time that wasn't during practice directly. During practice though, it was a combination of being, if we had some individuals that are rehabbing, I would have them off the side and taking them through some drills and taking them through some more rehab focused, either strengthening, mobility, agility, coordination type of activities, to help them, you know, feel involved and feel like they were doing something during practice, as opposed to just standing there for 2 hours watching, you know, the other team or the guys go through the full drills and full practice, which is great. And then the other hat I wore, I'm not a certified athletic trainer. So I'm not an ATC by license, but I got to learn and implement a lot of skills that I would say athletic trainers do a lot better than physical therapists do. So everything from if a guy comes off the court bleeding, I was there to acutely manage that. If a guy needed some type of retaping or taping, I was helping. Bob, my mentor, is much better than I am at all of this. So he was there involved, but sometimes there would be two guys that needed help. So I'd be attending to one or the other. Or Bob was, you know, busy doing something and I was there to help out real quick. So I would say I put my athletic trainer hat, I know I'm not a licensed ATC, but my ATC hat on for practice as well and help with some of that acute management skills moving forward.
And how was that transition for you? And that's one thing that I find kind of fascinating when I talk to people that are in some type of sports residency, because you do have an on-field commitment. I think, you know, in talking to you and talking to others, when you were interviewing with different programs, there was a discussion of, hey, this is the expectation when it comes to on-field. And I know a lot of them mandate that you have to be, you know, team coverage or on-field or in the training room for a key portion of the entire residency. So I guess, how was that transition for you? Is that something that you feel like as a, you know, 3 years of PT school adequately educated you for, or is that a lot of learning on the job?
I would say it's more learning on the job. The reason I hesitated there for a second is, so during my PT school experience, and this is more this specifically to myself, I sought out opportunities to learn from athletic trainers. I did some shadowing at a couple of different high schools and colleges around the state of Indiana. So I felt like coming into residency, I had a little bit better idea of maybe what an ATC does. Again, I'm not a licensed ATC, but I had a feeling of what they could do on the sideline. So I think I came into residency with maybe a little bit of a foundation or better understanding, but definitely a good amount of learning on the job too. I always share with individuals that have interest in sports PT residencies or working in a collaborative setting alongside athletic trainers or other, you know, healthcare professionals, is developing, I call it developing the soft skills. So what I mean by that is, one, simple things like, and I call them simple, but they're not, they're important, like setting up a Gatorade cooler or getting cups ready or having a towel ready for a guy if it comes off, you know, off the court for something, or being willing to run back and grab, you know, some ibuprofen or Tylenol for a guy if he is dealing with some, you know, pain or discomfort. So being able to do those little things that maybe might seem simple or I'm not sure how to say it, but just simple for lack of a better term, those are really impactful in the heat of a moment of a practice or a game when a guy is trying to get back or a coach needs a player back on the field or back on the court. being able to act quickly and be aware of those little things and not think that's less than what your license can do is really important and vital to success in the sports PT world when it's surrounded by other individuals and other professions.
That's interesting you bring that up. I can tell you from my experience with taking care of Purdue for 10 years, it took me a while to figure out some of that, that a Division I athletic training room, a Division I medical staff can be very territorial in my experience from time to time. And, there were definitely some times that I overstepped my bounds of what my role was, and I just didn't know any better. I don't know if it was for better or worse that those were the kind of bounds put around what was expected of me. But especially I find it even more in football where you have, three, four athletic trainers, you have students, you have three or four physicians, you have position coaches, you have a head coach, you have players of all different types, and there's 110 of them. Some of whom are five-star guys who are trying to buy their time till they're headed off to the NFL. Some of the guys that are going to be around there for 4 years as scout team guys that are never going to play. So it's a little bit, maybe a little bit less of that in basketball, but especially in a Division I football athletic training room, medical staff, it's kind of hard sometimes to find exactly what your role is. So has that been a part of your experience this year to kind of learn, where those kind of territorial boundaries are and how to, after a while you have to learn how to figure out not just where those boundaries are, but also how to work around them. I know this isn't really my thing and I've learned to stay in my lane, but where are some spots that I can suggest? Maybe we should try this because I thought about this way. Oh, that's a good idea. Even though it's not your thing, there still is that room, of course, for collaboration on a team of any size when it comes to a medical staff. So talk about your experience at UC a little bit with whether it's just with basketball or just in the department in general on that kind of territorial nature that can develop and how you navigate that.
For sure. Yeah, so for my role specifically as the men's basketball and Olympic sports physical therapy resident, this is actually the first year at UC that they have my role. In the past, our residency only took one resident. This is the first year that we actually have taken two residents. In the past, it was just one PT resident that worked solely with football. Once football season was over, that resident or that physical therapist got some more exposure to basketball or to other Olympic sports at UC, but it was mainly football. And so I share all that because one piece from the basketball side or my basketball hat on, I had to learn and kind of navigate some of that. I was lucky and honored to have Bob, who's our residency director, be the main individual I worked with from a medical perspective in the basketball circle. So it wasn't too of a new thing for him. Like he wasn't caught off guard of having a PT now on his medical staff on the basketball side. So that part was pretty seamless for me. But I would say from the Olympic sports side and working in the training room and the apartment total, it was definitely some learning curves of how to best approach treatment of athletes from different teams that have different athletic trainers. What I've learned, and I want to thank Jim Tursak, who's our director of rehab at UC and also another mentor of mine. He taught me early in my residency, I think it was the first couple of weeks, to be honest, about the best approach to approaching treating athletes that are on different teams. And the way I did it was, and this is from Jim's teaching, is to go to the athletic trainer, let's say for lacrosse, go into the athletic trainer for lacrosse and share that every athlete on the lacrosse team that is deemed necessary for PT is still their athlete. If they are post-op or if they have a condition that is deemed necessary for PT, they're 100% still their athlete. And what I mean by that is that the athletic trainer is 100% involved in the plan of care. I try to over-communicate with them and share everything I'm doing from an intervention selection, progression selection, and in terms of a return to sport or a discharge planning, the athletic trainer is fully involved in that discussion, even to the point where they say, I think we should go this way. And I'm pretty flexible in that discussion. I will share what my thoughts are and my clinical decision of why I want to go maybe this way compared to that way. And then we collaborate and move forward. It's been really good for me because I approach it from that perspective of if someone needs PT and they're on X team, they're still your athlete. They're not all of a sudden my athlete and I'm not making the decision of when they're going to be, starting a point guard or what it might be. So approaching it from a collaborative piece, as well as sharing that they are fully involved as the ATC in their care, has been a good response from my perspective and my experience.
And there's no you can't underestimate or you can't overstate how important it is to have good leadership when it comes to teams like that, from your athletic director down to your assistant ADs, your team physicians, your director of sports medicine, and then the individual athletic trainers at each level. And from my perspective, as you know, we had kind of head orthopedic surgeon, consultant orthopedic surgeons, and from the top down, the leadership piece really, I learned as I went, really mattered a lot to encourage that kind of collaboration. And you know, knowing whose domain what was, what thing was. Like if you see an athlete, you make a diagnosis, you come up with a treatment plan, and the head athletic trainer from that sport happens to be in another area, you're absolutely right. You gotta go find them, let them know what's going on, because that's a sure way to get you an angry phone call is tomorrow morning to be like, hey man, my athlete came and saw you yesterday. He or she tells me this. I was kind of flying blind when I went into that. I made that mistake a couple of times myself, and I eventually figured out, a quick message through our secure messaging app. Hey, I saw this athlete. This is what I found. Get it all down on paper, so we're all clear on exactly what my communications was. Not on paper, but on through the app was really helpful for that communication piece and making sure that everybody was on the same page.
I completely agree. I have found that the best collaboration and approach is when you just over communicate. And then a goal for yourself, as from a surgeon or physician's perspective, or for Scott and I, as from a rehab or a physical therapy perspective, is to provide the best care to the athlete or patient in front of us. And when that communication is clear and over communicated, I feel like the athlete gets the best care possible.
Mike, all great stuff there. I think that's a lot of good information for people that are thinking about residencies of any type, but definitely sports residencies, and especially at the, Division I, big time, high profile programs like UC is. So I appreciate you going over that. Before we wrap up, we want to cover one more thing with you. We were lucky enough to have Mike as a PT student at the Shelbourne East Center last year as part of his internship prior to his graduation in May of 23. So we worked with Mike for, 3 months or so, maybe?
Yep.
Yeah, three months or so. So Mike did awesome with us. Like I said, we're lucky to have him. And in a typical fashion, Mike wanted to go above and beyond and work on a research project with us. So, and because of his passion for basketball, he wanted to look into some of the outcomes as it pertains to higher level basketball players. So the title of the paper was "Return to Sport Rates and Objective Measures After ACL Reconstruction for High Level Basketball Players." And this was a project that Mike led along with some assistance from others in the office, and it was presented as a poster in Boston, Massachusetts as part of the APTA CSM meeting, and it will also be featured as a poster at the AOSSM meeting later this summer in Denver, Colorado. So, Mike, I guess I'll turn it to you, and just as we get started here, what was the rationale or reasons for why you wanted to conduct this study?
Appreciate it, Scott. Yeah, so during my time as a student at Shelbourne Knee Center, it was a great learning experience. It was my final or fourth clinical before graduation, and it was balancing everything from being a student and learning under Bill Clawson as my CI, as well as studying for my MPTE and also looking at residencies all at the same time. And it was a great environment to learn within with the flexibility that you all provide. So I wanted to thank you all for that. And then, as you mentioned, the ability to do some research. When I came into my clinical rotation at Shelbourne Knee Center, I knew that you all, one of your main pillars was just the abundance of research and knowledge that you all have from Dr. Shelbourne's initial work to what Dr. Benner does now and moving forward from your initiative, Scott, the great library of research that you all have. And if I could have been a small piece of that, it was an honor to do that. So my love for the game of basketball growing up playing basketball, I wanted to have basketball be some type of component of the research. And I knew that obviously ACL reconstruction is a big component of what you all do from a surgical perspective. So I wanted to see how return of sport rates and objective measures after ACL reconstruction for high level basketball players came through the retrospective study and the library of knowledge that you all have and data you all have. So the purpose for me for this study was to determine if objective measure differences following ACLR between basketball players competing at different levels, such as college or professional, high school, and then recreational levels was seen. We followed the modified Tegner scale, And I actually didn't know too much about it until diving into this research, but we looked at levels 10, 9, and 8. And the higher the number, the more competitive or higher level that that athlete would be considered. So level 10s in our research was a college or professional basketball player. Level 9 was considered a high school basketball player. And level 8s were more of the recreational, you know, YMCA, JCC, pickup basketball athlete. And so that was a really cool experience. I wanted to see if there was any differences in objective measures to see if there's anything that we can do clinically to help provide a better return to sport rate for basketball players.
Now, knowing that, what were you thinking prior to the analysis of the data? Were you thinking that one group was going to be more successful in returning to sport or have better outcomes? What was your thought process or your hypothesis for this study?
Initially, we were thinking, which might not be groundbreaking or shocking news to anybody, that our higher levels are, you know, level 10s or college and professional levels would just be have a superior performance with objective measures and following ACLR and comparing to those at level 9s or level 8s that are considered high school or recreational level basketball players.
Yeah, it's an interesting hypothesis. You know, from the very beginning, I think lay people in particular would think that people of level 10, you know, playing competitive high school and professional basketball would be the ones that are most likely to return to sport. And I think as I've gotten more time, you know, in taking care of Purdue and higher level athletes, I started to wonder whether that was necessarily the case, just because people are pushing themselves to higher levels. You know, obviously the bar is much higher. They want to be perfect yesterday. They don't want to be 90% in 6 months. They want to be perfect right now, and they don't want to have any limitations in their future. And that's those of us that treat ACL injuries know that's a very high bar to be able to get to. So, I agree with your hypothesis. It's just an interesting one when you start to think about the different factors that are at play among those different types of groups.
Yeah, I completely agree. As I think Scott and I did a lot of reflection on that too. And to echo your point there, Dr. Benner, in terms of what's the level that the athlete or the individual is trying to get back to play, I think is also a big component and give an important piece of that discussion in terms of if they're going back to a, you know, NBA, WNBA level or Division I college, or if they're trying to get back to playing, you know, Sunday mornings at the YMCA, that's a different goal and a different rehab goal. So I think I could not agree more.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell us a little bit about kind of what the methods were behind this study. What was our patient population? How do we separate them? And then what kind of outcome measures did we look at?
It was a retrospective study that was pulled data from the institutional database at Shelbourne Knee Center. It was looking at ACL reconstruction with that contralateral patellar tendon graft. We looked at that modified Tegner scale. So we, you know, preoperative activity of greater than 8 on the modified Tegner scale, as well as less than 25 years of age was important for inclusion criteria. And then the patients had a report that they played basketball to be involved in our study. We excluded individuals that had either revision surgeries, bilateral procedures, or missing data needed for analysis. And then from that, once we had our patient population, we split it into those, you know, preoperative levels of 8 for recreational, 9 for high school, and 10 for college or professional following that modified Tegner scale, which is great. And then from objective measures, we wanted to look at range of motion. So we looked at extension range of motion at 2 weeks, difference in flexion range of motion at 3 months, and then percent deficit in isokinetic quad strength and single leg hop for distance at 4 months, and then looked at that manual max difference for a KT arthrometer at 2 months as well. And then followed some statistical analysis that Scott led as well going through that.
So after you split those groups and knowing you were looking at those 4 or 5 different outcome measures, what were some of the main results that you found with this study?
So looking at from a return of sport rate for basketball players, there wasn't any significant difference from level 10 to level 9 to level 8. Our percentages were pretty high. It was actually 97.2% for 10, 96.4% for 9s, then 94.2% for level 8. So really good return to sport rate across all of our 3 different groups, which is really cool to see. And then our level 8s actually performed the most significance in terms of their isokinetic quadricep strength deficits as well as their hop distance deficits as well, too. So we saw a larger difference or a difference in there for our level 8s compared to our 9s and level 10s when it came to objective measures for hop test as well as quadricep strength.
So as you put all that together, those methods, those results, and kind of what the direction you thought the study was going, what are the main take-home points from this study, and how's it going to change your practice in the future?
So as I mentioned, the return to sport rate, or the rate of return to competitive basketball, was same among all the high-level basketball players. We saw that, you know, level 10s had superior strength and single leg hop performance compared to the recreational basketball players. And I think from a clinical relevance perspective, in terms of, you know, for the clinician on the call or on the podcast listening, for how they can take this information and move forward, you know, the return of sport to competitive basketball rate is same, as we mentioned, among all groups. But recreational basketball players tend to be weaker in terms of our research compared to those college or professional athletes. So I think emphasis on in their rehab in terms of increasing their strength and overall moving forward in sports performance, I think, is important. I remember reflecting on this more and looking at this differential, seeing the level 8 seem as a lower strength. Was that because of level 10s and level 9s having access to sports performance or strength and conditioning coaches at those levels, possibly? Or possibly once that level 8 was discharged from PT and was healthy enough to move forward, just didn't add the emphasis for gaining overall strength in their day, because, you know, their goal was getting back to just playing once a week with some friends. So I think as clinicians and as rehab professionals and specialists, I think when you discharge an individual from your care and from PT, providing, you know, a home exercise program, providing maybe just some educational points of how they could go into their local, you know, gym or local LA Fitness, YMCA, JCC to get a workout in, and focus on a couple of things to help continue to increase their strength. To set themselves up for success when they get back on the basketball court.
So in introducing this research study, we had mentioned that it was presented already at the confined sections meeting in Boston, Massachusetts earlier this year. So when you were presenting that, Mike, and you had some conversations with some colleagues and people that were walking by, any interesting conversations that you had at that time, or any interesting insights or questions that people had about it?
One interesting conversation, or I think it was a topic of discussion, was the approach that Dr. Shelburne, Dr. Benner used with that contralateral patellar tendon graft. I by no means can explain into detail that Dr. Benner can of some of the reasoning, but I understand that from my knowledge, from a rehab perspective, of taking the graft from the contralateral side allows the knee. So let's say your right knee is your ACL knee and your left knee is your graft knee. It's almost like you're working on two different rehabs, one that's focusing on the regeneration or the stimulation of the tendon tissue on the graft side to help that tendon regrow. And then it's obviously working on an ACL rehab in terms of diffusion control, range of motion, quadricep strength, and stability in that other knee as well, too. So when individuals saw on the poster that we use a contralateral graft at Shelburne Knee Center, some that was a known thing if they're deeper into physical therapy and orthopedic surgery research, or just know the Shelburne Knee Center name. But some that was just a unique topic of discussion. And luckily, too, Bill Clausen, who was my CI, was presenting some other research, and he was there for some of those discussions as well. So that was a topic that was unique that came up at CSM.
No matter where we go, no matter what we're talking about, that always seems to be a topic people always want to talk about. It's always interesting when, you know, after we present, people come up like, so seriously, you take it from the other knee all the time? Like, yeah, all the time, pretty much every time. And it's, I don't know if people think we're not telling the truth, or they're in disbelief. But you know, the interesting thing, that's the great thing about research, that there's not necessarily just, you know, what we think about it, what we hope will happen. It's this is what we've done and what the data has been able to teach us. So very good. Well, Mike, thanks again for coming on the podcast with us. I've really enjoyed this discussion. I think for PTs that are in your position or just before where your position is at now, I think with some good insights into that and your experiences, and a nice review of this paper that you did. So thanks again for the work that you did when you were studying with us, and best of luck moving forward.
Thank you, Dr. Benner. Thank you, Scott. I appreciate the time.
Join us again next week for our next episode, and we'd love to hear from you as well after that one. If you've listened to the previous content and like what you've heard, please leave us a 5-star review and some comments for those that come behind you, and review those social media channels, Facebook and YouTube. We have the Shelbourne East Center podcast pages. We also have Instagram and Twitter accounts at the SKC Podcast, and you can reach out to us at the SKC Podcast at gmail.com, and we'll see you next time.